The Teenage Werewolf came about when we published a book at Valentine called I, Libertine. Mm-hmm. And we took to advertising it by running our own bestseller list in the New York Times. And I got to make up the titles of all the books.
Oh, great idea.
And I, for 1 week, I had the title Martin Luther Meets the Wolfman. And Andy Stewart, the advertising man, said that the Lutherans were terribly serious types and we'd get in awful trouble if we did this. So it was a total emergency we put in the title. I was a teenage werewolf, and they made the movie. They, honest to God, they made the movie. They made the movie.
Well, we're going to just talk informally about paperback books and about yourself. I take the tape and I'll edit it so as though it's this has no resemblance to any television talk show or anything like that. Very modest little broadcast. Just scoot in just a little, just move over that way a little bit. And let's go back. It was about 1937. You were 22 years old. You were approached by an English outfit to start an American market for paperbacks. Do you remember that far back?
Well, I do. It was 39.
39.
And it was me that was the approacher.
Mm-hmm.
Alan Lane had got paid $1,000 to an American lawyer to learn that he couldn't bring Penguin books to America.
Why?
Because of the copyright law. Until recently, our country had a worse copyright law than the Russians. It had a manufacturing clause in it, which was designed to protect American printers at the disadvantage of authors. And if a book was copyright, you couldn't bring it in. It was a tariff, infinite tariff. And a teacher of mine at the London School of Economics told me about this, and I went and looked in the library and found that the Oxford University Press had met and solved this problem in 1910. They did it by resigning the copyright. And so I went to Alan Lane and said, I know how to get your books into America, and why don't I do it? And he thought that was a very good idea. So we started in July of 39, the very first month that Pocketbook started in this country.
Boy, what a coincidence that Penguin and Pocketbook started at the same time.
Well, actually, some of it was. Some of Bob DeGraff, Pocketbook's originator, is encouraged by the success of Penguin. He was citing that as one of his reasons for believing things would work. Because Penguin had started in 35 in Britain. It was a time when people said in the U.S. that Europeans were the types that would read paper-bound books, but Americans would never do that.
The you mentioned that the clause was resigning the copyright. Now, I'm not exactly sure what that means.
The copyright is a formal record kept by the government in the event that there is a dispute. And if you ask them to take away their formal record, there's nothing they can do. They have to give it up. And if they don't have it there anymore, then customs would have no excuse for stopping the book.
Well, what's to prevent other people from taking
the
advantage?
The low price of a paper-bound edition. Plus the fact that these were generally books of substantial merit. Liberty in the Modern State, of Harold Laski, and Religion and the Rise of Capitalism by Tawney, and Thinking to Some Purpose by Susan Stebbingham. There were serious books that where the publisher would not pirate lightly.
Why did you feel that there was a need for paper-bound books in the United States?
My uncle, Sox Cummins, was the first editor at Random House, and he also was the editor of Modern Library. And I had observed an early American experiment, an earlier one called Modern Age Books. And my uncle, who was a hardbound editor, said, this will never work. And I did a paper for the Columbia senior class in economics, which where I was studying, saying that it would work, but they were doing it wrong. As a matter of fact, I had my paper when I applied for the job at 22 with Alan Lay, who gave me my paper to read. I thought that increasing the number of books that reached people was a very good idea.
Of course, there had been paperback books before in this country, hadn't there?
Very much so, until 1890, when the law was changed. There were what we think of as the dime novels, but they were much better than our memory. They had Dickens and all kinds of good authors, as well as junk.
The paperback really changed America's reading habits, didn't it?
It did indeed. And there are a few books that one has published there, one can feel that they had an actual impact on events and on public opinion that you could encounter, let's say, on college campuses, individuals who, if they'd not read the book, had come across the ideas of the book. A book like Paul Ehrlich's book, The Population Bomb, is an example of that kind of book. Or Diet for a Small Planet. These are pivotal books and mind-changing books, and they're great fun to publish.
Where did you distribute these books?
When?
Where?
Oh, no. Where, when?
Well, let's go back. Let's continue to talk about the Penguin books.
Well, at the beginning, there were only 500 bookstores in America regularly paying their bills. There was no distribution channel, and you had to go out and find it.
500 bookstores?
That's all. There were no bookstores in the whole state of North and South Dakota. And the book distribution in this country was absolutely awful. However, the booksellers didn't take to paper-bound books. They thought that low-cost books would ruin the market for the books they normally sold. And I had a number of booksellers look at the Penguin books and tell me that if the books were more junky, they'd be glad to take them in, but they were too good. They'd wreck everything. And they, but the development of the paper-bound book in this country was not a development of a change in production. Later on, when the whole thing was up and running, production changed. But it was inventions in distribution. And this meant using magazine wholesalers, who in some instances were also newspaper wholesalers. And some of them were rather rugged types.
So these using the magazine distributors meant that you got the paperbacks in places like magazine shops, bus stations, drugstores. Yes. Eventually, I guess, the supermarket chains picked them up.
Well, yeah, supermarkets hadn't really started up at that time. They came later.
Mm-hmm.
But there were wholesalers in the East who were not interested in drugstores because they were newspaper wholesalers, and the dumb druggists didn't open their stores at 6 o'clock in the morning when they thought they should, and they wouldn't distribute to them. It was a piece-by-piece job of convincing people that the idea was a good one. However, when World War II came along and there was an immense shortage of everything, and the wholesalers were glad to have anything to sell, and that loosened things up considerably.
Did you have anything to do with these little armed horses?
I'm very proud I did the very first one.
What was that?
It was The Moon Is Down by John Steinbeck, and it was done on the formula of the Armed Services Edition. Once the Armed Services Edition had happened, and it became a non-profit activity of the Council of Books on Wartime, a library of 50 books went out to every unit, it was never again going to be the case that you could say that Americans didn't read paper-bound books. And right after the war, there was a sensible, total explosion of interest in paper-bound books because all the servicemen came back and were used to paper-bound books.
Were you on this council?
No, I just said that I was a paper-bounder who had got my nose in the tent, and I very sensibly didn't remind all of the people who had the rights to all of the desirable books that they were busy digging their graves. Because I was still very intent on the competition between hardbound and paperbound books. But I worked with a man named Ray Troutman, a colonel. And there was a critical moment in getting all that to happen that was handled by Colonel Green of the Infantry Journal. The books were, hardcover books, were treated by the military as being accountable. They were like a rifle. If you lost one, you had to pay for it. And if paper-bound books were to be used by the armed forces, we had to get hold of the fellow who was the head accountant of all the head accountants and had a big meeting with him. And when we were showing him a dummy of the book, Colonel Green said, "And this will have a second use in the field." And the penny dropped, and the accountant said, "Oh, well, in that case, they're expendable." And had he not ruled that they were expendable, none of the rest of it could have happened.
You left Penguin, and you started your own.
I started Bantam Books, and then 6 years after that, started Ballantyne Books.
You started Bantam before Ballantyne?
Yes, sir. Uh-huh.
Tell me about the origins of Bantam. How did that get underway?
Well, I had a difference with Alan Lane. We were doing a large number of military books, and the war was over for him when it ended in Europe, and it wasn't over for us. So I undertook to continue the military books, which carried with it a risk that the war would end and they would all be returned, the unsold one. And this was admired by the Curtis Circulation Company, the publishers of the Saturday Evening Post. And they said they would like to distribute a line of paper-bound books. So I went to my uncle's employer, Bennett Cerf, who I also knew from having hung around Random House a lot. And he had just become part of a group called Grosset and Dunlap, which was the Book of the Month Club and three other hardcover publishers. And they decided that this would all be a good investment. Bernie Geis thought of the name Bantam.
Just out of the clear blue sky?
Yes. Although when Bennett asked me about it, I couldn't resist it. I said that I had this astrologer, Bennett, and the astrologer says the right name is Bantam. And I see Bennett's eyes roll up into his head. They're, "My God, I've got a queer one here." And Bennett was fun to tease. But it was a very powerful combination. I still have our opening ad, and in that same issue of Publishers Weekly, there was a page ad from Bob DeGraff greeting us, welcoming us into the game.
What was the first issue?
We did 20 titles. The first book was Life on the Mississippi, to show that we thoroughly broke it with the British origins.
What year was that?
45.
1945. How long were you with Bantam?
6 years.
6 years, and you were the publisher, editor-in-chief?
Yes, I was the presidente.
You were everything, the major domo. Well,
I tell the Bantam people now that I'm the only founder you ever had.
And what wonderful books for a quarter. It's hard to believe. You know, you look at the cost of a paperback today, and it's $3-4. But just to think back that this wonderful literature contained in these little books for a quarter, it was incredible. When I was a young man, when I was a teenager, and in high school and later in college, well, we could never afford hardcover books, even though they only ran $2 or $3 in those days. But everybody bought paperbacks. My library was filled with paperbacks, and which I kept neatly ordered, alphabetically, arranged nicely, carried with me my Volkswagen from one place to another, and still have a great many of them. Ballantine books, how did that start?
Well, we wanted to do original publishing. We'd been doing reprint publishing, and our competitors were all continuing to do reprint publishing, but we wanted to do originals. We thought there were different books to do for the paperbound audience than the books that hardbound editors were picking for hardbound readers. And the also there was an economic thing that the authors were not getting a very fair shake. The hardcover publishers were taking half of all the paperbound income, and we had the idea the author should have all of the paperbound income. Made us very popular with authors. I felt a step towards maturity in publishing. One could then generate one's own audiences, and also having a direct relationship with an author is an extremely stimulating and rewarding thing. The hardcover publisher, if he was smart, kept you, if you were a reprinter, completely away from the author.
What was the first Ballantine title?
Number one was Executive Suite by Cameron Hawley. It became a bestseller simultaneously, hardcover and paperbound. Being a book for businessmen, the businessmen didn't notice that there was a paperbound edition. So.
That was a concept you originated, wasn't it? The combination
it was,
of hard,
yes,
and soft?
Yes. But our idea was that there was the hardbound edition was for the libraries. I recently went this summer to a meeting of the Paperbound Book Nuts of America, the first time they ever met.
That's their name?
Yes. No. The people who collect mass market paperbound books. And I discovered to my astonishment that the hardcover Ballantine editions are great rarities and command at auction very substantial prices, like $1,500 each.
Those early titles?
For the early titles, yeah.
Well, I know that one of the early titles, which is now still graces my bookshelves, is a book that I could not afford in hardcover, but I got the paper, and it was Fahrenheit 451 by Ray Bradbury.
Yes.
Which is considered greatly a collector's item. And I was also a paperback nut with regard to science fiction. I still have all of my old science fiction, and you had Arthur C. Clarke, as I recall, and you had many of the great science fiction writers of the 50s. That's where my interest...
Nobody else wanted to do them, and as a matter of fact, both Dell and Bantam looked at science fiction and came back and said that they didn't sell well enough for them to want to publish. But I felt a very sensible thing in publishing, if you can cozy up to the authors who are thinking about what's going to happen next.
Signet did a lot of science fiction during that period, too. But the Signet books didn't look as nice as the Ballantine books.
Well,
Ballantines always had slicker covers. They felt heavier. They felt better.
Well, they were all one artist. We were all Richard Powers. And we took a risk. We did 5 Richard Power covers with the conventional symbol in the illustration, the rocket ship or the spacesuit. And then we did a surrealist scene for an Arthur C. Clarke. And it worked. we got them. And then we didn't look back. We would not do a conventional kind. We did this surrealistic thing, and then our competitors all looked at this and decided they wanted to look like us. And this was very good for Richard Powers. It also was very good for Ballantine Books, because we were a small organization with few salesmen, with salesmen from large organizations going around saying that we wished we were as good as they are.
You found out early on when you were back at Bantam that it was difficult to print a paperback that ran too many pages, like more than 190, as I recall. The bigger the paperback, it just didn't seem to work out. Is that correct, in terms of size?
Well, I can't say that that happened to me, because I did Roosevelt and Hopkins, and I did Inside USA
Roosevelt
at
Hopkins.
Bantam before I left.
Well, I did Roosevelt and Hopkins was in two editions, though. Right? It was in two
volumes, yes. But they were 500 pages each. There was a way of doing the long book. But, of course, the time comes when it's much better if you can make it a different size, if you can make it a larger book, a larger page size for a long, long book. And then the illustrated book had to be a bigger page size to be any use at all.
I sometimes am very grateful when I run into a thin book. I do this broadcast 5 days a week, and it seems that authors these days are trying to outdo themselves by, if somebody writes a 600-page novel, the next guy comes up with a 700-page novel, then the next one an 800-page novel, and they keep getting bigger and bigger, and it takes its toll. I got one today by E.L. Doctorow, a new collection of short stories, and it's only about that thick, and I'm looking forward to sitting down.
Because
he's a slow read. He's a tough read.
Yes, the college bookseller will tell you on the reading list that he can always predict which one will sell the largest number, and he can do it by this, an inverse relationship to the page length.
So many of the Ballantine books, most of the early Ballantine books were original books. They were not reprints.
No.
It's a whole new concept, I guess, wasn't it?
It was marketing. Then, yes. Fawcett was doing gold medal books as originals for a different reason. They had a distribution agreement which prohibited their doing reprints. And but they were concentrating on a limited editorial area.
Isn't it interesting that publishing seems to be so incestuous or cannibalistic or something, because Ballantine Books is now back under the Random House Bantam umbrella?
I claim it's like the Englewood Players, the amateur theatrical, where they're an insufficient number. And the fellow comes on, it's the first act is the chauffeur, appears in the third act is the butler. What's really the case is that there's, in order to have experience, the only way you can do it is be in one of the places where experience is taking place. And there is actually, among the people who are in the game, there's a fair amount of camaraderie, because the truth is, in publishing, the better the players, the better the game. The sad thing is for someone to imitate you and do it badly. Someone comes along and says, that thing you were doing, it used to work so well, it doesn't work that well anymore.
Why is it there seems to be so much turnover in the publishing industry? An editor goes from one house to another, publishers change.
I think it's one of the stupid inefficiencies of commerce, that no one gives people a raise until they come in and say, I've had an offer somewhere else. And I think it's very bad. I tried to avoid it when I owned the company by making sure that I got to the fellow with a raise before that kind of thing would happen. And there is a certain amount of turnover. But if you've been in, if you came in the very beginning as I do, then I have reconciled it to it, and I sort of feel that the at least half of all the people doing it are now my blood relatives.
There's the incest again.
Yes.
Well, publishing, though, is historically, as a except for the top editors, publishers, is a relatively low-paying industry, isn't it?
It is for everybody. You don't make that much money publishing books, usually. It's really a windfall. I had a course at Ballantine Books I taught years ago when the summer was very hot and people wanted to stay in the office for the air conditioning. It was called The Innermost Secrets of the Business, or How the Money Gets Made. And fundamentally, when you're planning a book as a business person, you want to plan on the book being very, very good. So you skate close to the edge in the amount of book that you give for the price. And if you get it really right and the book takes off and becomes a bestseller, then you get a windfall profit. And that all works, but it makes accountants and graduates from the Harvard Business School terribly nervous.
Ian Ballantine, you're still turning out books, and I think you're very proud of. Is that the gnomes?
Is the secret of the gnomes?
Tell me a little bit about that. I know that's one of your loves. You've always had the feeling for science fiction and fantasy, and here's the secret of the gnomes. I guess that is an idea that really caught on, didn't it?
That was a first volume, Gnomes, by two Dutchmen, an artist and a writer. It was very successful. And they received, after the publication of their first book, a letter from the Finnish Gnomes saying that, unfortunately, they'd gotten everything wrong in the first book, and inviting them to come to Finland to observe how things really were. And they made the trip. The gnomes sent them railroad tickets. They made the trip and discovered all kinds of things, including something which we were able to use for the smallest posters that have ever been offered the booksellers by a publisher. They had made the first authentic portraits of the Abominable Snowman and the Abominable Snowwoman and the Abominable Snow Child. The ideas and the quality of these books has ties directly to environmental interests, but also have got, I think, the essential of fantasy. And this is happening now in what I'm calling fantasy art. If I may, I'll backtrack. When Tolkien came with The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, that changed things forever. Fantasy had been considered to be juvenile. We now were able to establish that fantasy was adult. In fact, we did a line of books at Ballantine with a unicorn's head in the circle and the words adult fantasy, so that you would know that Gormenghast by Mervyn Peake was for adults and The Worm Ouroboros was for adults. The nature of the adult fantasy, in my opinion, was that it was sufficiently complex to engage an adult intelligence, but it was also participatory. The author drew you in, and you found yourself conjuring, going on yourself with the set of ideas that you encountered in the fantasy. The authors and the artist of The Secret of the Gnomes does this. They catch your interest, but you can begin to make up your own stories after you've gone partly through the book. And I think it's that quality of participation that's so engaging and so intriguing.
Barney Rossett was telling me a couple of months back that he looked at Tolkien's and book Lord of the Rings and The Hobbits, and he thought it was terrible. He thought it was terrible. And he said, who wants to read about hobbits, you know? And he turned it down. He said, God, you know, You see, if I'd only bought that, it would have been a life preserver. They have all sorts of, it's a kind of unusual press, a Grove Press, kind of an unusual little press, and he takes a lot of chances on books that don't sell very much. So he says, well, what a mistake. Do you ever make a mistake like that, where you've turned down something that has just taken off somewhere else?
Oh, yes. And once I did it because I absolutely had to. Viking sent me the manuscript of Kerouac's On the Road. My 15-year-old son had just announced that he was leaving for Canada on his bicycle and he was going to support life with his 22 and his fishing rod. And I knew the book would sell, but I also knew there would be no way of explaining it to Richard if we published it and said he couldn't go to Canada. But we've had that kind of episode. I think the appreciation of books by a publisher is a matter of following a line of interest. In fact, you can see things that can sell but don't move you. You're not in sympathy with them, and you're wise to avoid them.
That's because you don't have, or one wouldn't have, the commitment to it.
And you don't have that, you can't put that body English into it, that in the publishing. Because the attention you get for books is really a marvelous thing. I mean, it's mostly because it's an infectious enthusiasm.
Ian Valentine, your wife has worked very closely with you.
Oh, very much so, yes.
What has been her role in working with Valentine?
Well, first of all, we've always called her higher authority. Anyone in publishing who thinks the ladies are not important is one big damn fool. She has been a working editor, worked with Arthur C. Clarke and Anne McCaffrey, and most recently with Shirley MacLaine. And we talk about things, but don't double up. We don't go on the same dates together. And she's taken tremendous interest in all of this.
Ian Valentine, thank you very much for coming in and chatting with me and sharing your thoughts about the publishing industry and the origins of paperback books, because, as I mentioned before, it really did change our reading habits. I remember when I was, I must have been 11, 12, went to the drugstore, and there was a book called The History of Burlesque or something. It was a paperback. I don't know who published it. Don't think it was Madam. But it was nicely illustrated, and it wasn't, it was a nice book. It showed the comedians and the old, I guess it showed the old-time strippers, but they're not like you consider burlesque today. And I remember the druggist would not sell me the book. He said, "Now you have to go home and get your mother to write me a note, and if she says it's all right, then I'll sell you this book," which was a quarter. And I was so disappointed, so disgusted. And I thought my mother probably would let me buy it, but I was embarrassed to go back to the drugstore with a note, so I never have read that book. I keep thinking that maybe one of these days I'll run into it, you know, and I'll be able to catch up on what I missed when I was 11.
If my idea about the one role of books being that they teach you to conjure, you possibly have thought of a far better book than that book really is by now in your imagination.
That's right. Ian Valentine, thank you very much for coming in and talking to me.